But first, a warning. Ian Dunt and I abhor, shall we say, voyeurism in politics. We detest the invasion of privacy. The way people are, you know, so salacious about the sexual goings-on of political figures. We won't have a bar of it. But tonight, unfortunately, we are going to be forced to talk a little bit about it because it's become such a big issue in the United Kingdom. So Ian and I have both promised off-air that we'll try and keep it merely R-rated and not X-rated. Ian, it's a very difficult thing for us to handle, but would you like to open the batting with a bit of kiss and tell on Matt Hancock?
I can, and I think a public warning, because there are photos and, unfortunately, videos, which for some reason are always much more horrifying, of the steamy clench in quotes, this is how all the newspapers describe these things, which really is sort of kissing and groping, that the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, engaged in with his senior aide in his office. Matt Hancock is not necessarily a bronzed Adonis, and the imagery is quite disturbing and quite unsettling to your internal life. So I would strongly advise anyone listening to this to not seek out that video and not look at the photographs. He did this, and this is really the crucial part, during a period of the COVID restrictions where you weren't allowed to hug anyone. Now, that's quite pertinent because, of course, we don't really care about the affair. And even in this country, where I think when I was a child growing up in the 90s, affairs were still considered sort of newsworthy in their own right and, you know, career destroying in their own right for politicians. That's not really the case anymore. And there is a much more liberal, tolerant sense of, look, this is a thing that happens and it's not really pertinent to the politics. What is pertinent is the fact that at the same point that he was telling people not to hug, including, by the way, people who were unable to hug their family at the funerals of loved ones, and that incidentally includes the Queen, of whom there are photos of her sitting alone during her husband's funeral, unable to be next to someone, he was in his office engaging in that steamy clinch. And for that reason, although he and the Prime Minister tried to ride out the storm for about 48 hours, they ultimately failed and he had to resign.
Who was his steaming clinchee?
Right, yeah, so this is his senior aide. Her name is Colin DeGello. A very difficult name to say, I'm sorry to say. It's kind of an interesting situation. So they did know each other in university. However, in March last year, she became non-executive director at the Department for Health. Then she became a member of the department's oversight board and started being paid public money. Now, that raised the series of questions. For instance, you know, did Matt Hancock tell people that he was having an affair with this person when he authorized them to take that position, a position that gave her public money and considerable oversight? Because, I mean, even if you're going to be quite liberal, as I am, and sort of say, you know, it doesn't matter whether people have affairs, I don't strictly feel that I should actually, as a taxpayer, be in the position where I have to actually pay for them to have the affair. And that does seem to be what happened here. And so, again, you got all
you
of these...
You are quite sometimes, Ian, a bit of a party pooper, really.
I know, it's deeply unfair of me. And I'm
a
sure
conservative party pooper.
However, not that difficult for Matt Hancock, because it seems that on the Thursday night that the story originally broke, the first thing he did, rather than what we're used to seeing, is sort of wheeling out the family to say, oh, they're sticking with him. In fact, he just went straight home and left his wife. According to reports in the Sunday Times, woke up his children in bed to say that he was leaving mummy and then hopped off. So actually, the affair is now that the primary relationship that he's in and the political career that he had has now gone away. Now, there are other political implications to this, by the way, and the political implications we're starting to see in COVID policy, because Matt Hancock, I mean, abysmal mediocrity that he was one of the highest performing and most intelligent ministers in Boris Johnson's cabinet. You don't have to be very smart to do that well in that cabinet, and indeed he wasn't, and therefore he did. So when he was replaced by Sajid Javid, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, COVID policy fundamentally changed. Matt Hancock was very stern on COVID policy. He made the public health case. That led to quicker lockdowns, still very, very slow, but quicker than they might otherwise have been. Sajid Javid is one of those who is essentially looking at the issue as an economic issue and saying, no, we just need to open up now. So actually, the steamy clinch, as absurd as it was, actually has resulted in really quite consequential policy change.
Now, India announced its new variant within the borders, and Boris responded with a bit of Boris dancing, a complete travel ban from Bangladesh and Pakistan, but not India. Why? This sounds a bit Monty Python.
It was extraordinary, wasn't it? It was well over 2 weeks after they announced it that they put Bangladesh and Pakistan on the red list. And we sat there for a long time. You just sort of thought, because given that that's where the variant was, it just seemed to make no sense. And then we finally realised, which is that Boris Johnson was desperately in his post-Brexit stage trying to get a trade deal with Modi in India. He had, in fact, a visit to go see Modi in a couple of weeks after that. So he kept it off the red list. In fact, it wasn't days, well over a week after that, that India did get put on the red list. And even then, instead of making the decision and activating it, they made the decision and then delayed it for 4 days, which allowed lots of people to take the flights over to the UK before the deadline. Now, we now know that is part of the process that really seeded the Delta variant into the UK. And if you look at the charts, the Delta variant is now rampaging through the UK, even as we open up. It's absolutely rampaging through the country. It would have got here eventually. I mean, it would have. You can't stop these things. What you can do is buy yourself time. And as it turned out, we didn't know it then, that time was essential. Because one jab, which is what about half the population has, either that or none, really doesn't protect you very much at all. Two jabs does protect you really rather a lot. And yet we lost that time because they made that foolhardy, deeply short-sighted and superficial decision on the red list.
Now, there's been a by-election which Labour has won, but you don't think it's necessarily a cause for celebration.
No, I mean, I have to tell you, every time I talk to you, there's been another by-election. They do seem to be coming really rather regularly at the moment. And this one, unlike most of the others, has provided a bit of relief to Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, partly because nobody thought Labour was going to hold on. It was a Labour-held seat. But, you know, there's lots of concerns about his leadership. There's lots of ideas about the Tories being buoyant. And yet he did hold on. He held on very tightly. It was 323 votes in the end. However, the real sort of lesson of what went on here was less about that and really about these very dark forces being unleashed on that constituency. Now, this is the constituency of Joe Cox. 5 years ago, Joe Cox, the Labour MP there during the Brexit referendum, was murdered by a fascist shouting about this is about Britain first as he murdered her. Now, her sister, Kim Ledbetter, is the Labour MP that stood this time round, partly in her name, partly in her own name. She was subjected to some of the most atrocious behaviour. I mean, she was accosted by groups of sort of male homophobes shouting at her. They chased her down the street. Labour campaigners going around houses for her were pelted with eggs. They were beaten up. They were kicked and punched on the street. And this had many reasons for it, but one of the primary ones was a man called George Galloway, who is a sort of hardcore figure on the left, who came in and stirred up as much tension and hatred and vitriol as he possibly could.
Ian, I'm glad we're discussing Galloway. I've wanted to ask you about him again and again and again. A brief political history, if you please.
Well, he was the MP for in Glasgow quite some time ago, really, sort of probably about 20 years ago now. Labour MP, very anti-war, very against any kind of military intervention. So really on the sort of Corbyn side of the party, you know, very, very critical of Israel, critical of the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, you know, wars that you'd be sympathetic about the opposition, but also wars that you wouldn't be sympathetic about the opposition, arguably. Very, very left-wing. He then got chucked out of the party, essentially for sort of calling people to, you know, opposing armies to take on British troops, and has since degenerated into one of the classical, you know, very friendly towards Russia, very friendly towards China. He frames himself as a friend of Muslims, and in fact, he tends to go to constituencies where there's a strong Muslim vote, where he can whip up sort of tensions against sort of the white community predominantly on issues like caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, on issues like the teaching of about LGBT rights in schools. However, he is no real friend of Muslims. If you actually look at the information that he puts out, I mean, for instance, he has called a hoax two of the chemical weapons attacks launched by Assad against Muslims in his country. He has denied that China has concentration camps for Uyghur Muslims in its own territory. In reality, he's a friend of dictators and totalitarians, and he tries to sort of exploit the Muslim vote wherever he can. He tried to do that here. It was extremely pernicious, an extremely, extremely ugly campaign. And he came within a whisker of succeeding, but he failed. And Starmer's party won it, 323 votes, which was essentially, I mean, beyond the politics of it, it did feel like a slim but important victory for decency.
So he's the inventor of the so-called Workers' Party?
Yes, exactly. But I mean, you know, just, I mean, a few short months ago, he was running in Scotland on completely different terms, where he dressed himself up as this sort of this gentleman of the moors, you know, and just top hat and a very different sort of proposition for a very different set of voters. I mean, really, most of the politics around him and certainly the image that he projects changes quite a bit. But what stays is that instinctive anti-Western bias and that instinctive sympathy towards Russia and China.
Now, finally, briefly, our sports segment. There's politics flying around the English team in the Euro Cup.
Extraordinary things happening to the English. I mean, the English team, you would thought that Boris Johnson and Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, would be very keen on them doing well in the Euros. They're in for their semi-final clash with Denmark tonight. However, something interesting happened, which is that the English team started taking the knee before matches. Now, originally when they did this, there was lots of boos, lots of shouts against them on the field. Boris Johnson wouldn't come out to defend them. Priti Patel spoke out against them. It all got very Brexity. Now, as they're doing better, the boos have disappeared. The cheers have gotten louder. And Boris Johnson and Priti Patel are suddenly having to pretend that they support the England team. So this very difficult situation where they would want to go all Brexity and nationalist around it has become very difficult because suddenly the England team are displaying all these signs of wokeness, which of course the Tory government typically decides that it despises.
How is the incumbent Labour leader travelling at the moment, Ian?
He's struggling a little bit, it has to be said. I mean, he's just been given this second shot by the by-election campaign. However, he is attacking the government on opening up on COVID restrictions as well. He might. There is a bit of a weakness there, I think, because Labour hasn't really put forward an alternate plan for COVID. It has little disparate ideas, most of them sensible, most of them welcome, for instance, like increasing ventilation in buildings. But it hasn't really come up with a core alternate proposal. So he still looks a bit like he's sort of, the phrase that's used against him is Captain Hindsight. It's not entirely fair, but there is a sense that the Labour leader hasn't done enough to defend himself against it, and that situation continues.
And the incumbent at number 10?
Has now just entirely lost in sort of baseless optimism, really. On the 19th of July, he plans to lift all remaining restrictions, essentially, apart from a couple on schools. Now, you know, when you look at the scale of the infection rate, I mean, we're expecting well over 100,000 infections, you know, in the next few weeks. We're expecting millions of people to become infected. The vaccines have broken some of the link between hospitalizations and deaths, but they have not eradicated it. We know that we're going to see more hospitalizations, more deaths as a result of this policy. However, he's doing it anyway, because once again, that sort of supposedly libertarian wing of the Conservative Party has decided that it's its religious mission in life in order to promote the ending of the wearing of face masks, for instance. And for some reason that simply cannot be articulated by any rational brain, the Prime Minister has decided to submit to their desires.
Let's take the knee for Ian Dunt. We'll catch you again in 2 weeks, so look after yourself and keep wearing your mask. Ian, of course, is editor of politics.co.uk.